Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, big news today. The horse that won the Kentucky Derby, they had some drug problems, maybe. Evidently going to be able to race in the Preakness Stakes coming up this weekend. And from what I'm reading, this is the first time they've let a horse that has had drug problems run in another race. And this part of me goes, I kind of get the fairness. The drug test was wrong. You know, you get to do this. But what if it wasn't? And he wins another one. That's going to be interesting. But here to share some thoughts on, the Medina Spirit horse, the race, our horse racing expert, I've asked our good friend Travis Waldron to come back and talk with us. He's a reporter over at Huffington Post. He covers politics and sports in Brazil and across the U.S. And is in Kentucky, where the Derby actually happened. You may remember our conversation about the valets who may have gone on strike. Travis, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course.
So let's start with the strike. Didn't happen. I was kind of surprised. Didn't happen.
It didn't happen. I wouldn't say I'm completely surprised that it didn't happen. You know, I mentioned, I think, when I was on the show that the valets at Churchill and other tracks, they also, a lot of their compensation comes from agreements, commission-based agreements with jockeys and trainers. And so the Derby Day is obviously a big money day for them in that front too. So, at the very least, it seems they got an agreement to keep talking and negotiating about the contract on better terms than what they thought they had before the race. Well, so
I wish them the best, and I hope they get a good contract and they get what they deserve. Let's talk about the Medina Spirit horse, 12 to 1 odds. I wish I'd have put money down.
I had him in my bet, but I didn't have the other horses.
Oh, so you can't just pick the winner. You got to pick other ones too.
Well, you can, but you know, I tried to pick the top two and I picked number one and number three, but not number two, which you don't get anything for that.
Yeah, you get nothing for that. But the horse won and has some drug issues. What are the drug issues? What for those of us who don't know much about horse racing, what is the issue?
So it was a drug that was a corticosteroid. So not like an anabolic performance enhancing steroid, but more like an anti-inflammatory, I guess. I'm not a pharmacist or a drug expert, so I'm not exactly sure what the drug itself was, but or even how to pronounce it necessarily.
Right.
But now Bob Baffert, the trainer, is claiming that it came from a dermatitis treatment. This is like his third set of claims for what it came from, so you know, who knows. And as several horse racing journalists have written this week, this is not the first time Bob Baffert has had these sorts of questions around his horses, and not the first time that a lot of these questions have been raised about horse racing, although it is pretty much the biggest one ever at the Kentucky Derby, at least in recent times. And the test is still outstanding, I guess. They're retesting a split sample. So even though he's running in the Preakness this week, it's still possible that his Derby win gets invalidated, which is a bummer for the horse because he didn't have anything to do with
it. Yeah, well, I don't think the horse knows either way.
Right.
What about the people who placed bets and won? What if you picked the secondary winner horse and you got cheated? You got stiffed.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't gamble enough to know the answer to that question necessarily. I assume that they would somehow pay back the people who at least had the number two horse, because it would be a pretty big bummer if you bet him to win and now he's the winner. We did have this. There was a controversy at the Derby a couple years ago where there was a disqualification, but that happened basically in real time. This is, you know, we're now a week later. Almost 2 weeks later. So it's, I don't know how they would handle it, but luckily I haven't had to worry about it because my bets all were wrong, matter what they decide.
Yeah, but what happens if you won? Do they come back and try and claw back their money from you? How would they know?
I assume they don't do that. I can't imagine like how that would be logistical.
But it's just terrible. So now this horse is going to run in the next race. Has that happened before? I mean, because, you know, I was sitting here thinking about, you know, all the talk about cancel culture, and because this Baffert guy did a really great job of going out there and using that frame. They've used it so much that they influenced the board of this race to go, oh, yeah, we'll make an exception this one time in like a gazillion years just for you because you used the word cancel culture.
Right. It's amazing that cancel culture is now just, you know, and it always has been at this point, like whatever you want it to be. Against any sort of criticism whatsoever. I'm not positive that it doesn't seem like there's ever been a case like this. I'm not sure there has ever been a case to even sort of test it on this level. You know, like I mentioned, there was a disqualification in the Derby a few years ago, but that had to do with an on-track infraction, not a random drug test. And so, you know, I don't know that the people running the Preakness have ever had to deal with something like this coming out of the Derby, at least not that I think there was one Derby horse disqualified for a drug test back in the 60s, maybe, but it hasn't happened anytime recently. And so it's kind of an unprecedented, weird situation. And then you throw on that horse racing is regulated by the states. So Kentucky and Churchill Downs and Maryland and Pimlico kind of all have their own jurisdictions and get to set their own rules and decide what they want to do. So there's not like one big national governing body that says, oh, you messed up in Kentucky, so now you can't run in Maryland.
Right. I can see that. Maybe there should be. I mean, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. Any chance the horses can actually win? Because it's now, I guess, a 9-5 favorite. Is that what I'm reading?
Yeah, I mean, I think other than last year, Baffert's undefeated when he takes a Derby winner to the Preakness, which last year they ran him out of order, so it doesn't really count. But, you know, I wouldn't bet against him, but I'm probably not going to bet it because I, you know, threw away my money last weekend.
Yeah, I haven't gambled in probably 30 years because I hate losing, and
yeah.
It is what it is. I did want to change topics. We'll see how the race turns out. Move over to another race, the race to get DC statehood. You're part of a team that's come out with an article. There's never been a good argument against DC statehood. Why has it taken so long to get statehood for DC? I mean, this is something that, you know, 30 years ago I remember people, you know, arguing for.
I mean, the shortest answer is the most obvious one, which is that it's racism. You know, DC for most of its history has been a majority black population. It's currently right under a majority black population and still majority minority. It's, I think, about 46% black and I think 11 to 12% Hispanic and Latino. So, I mean, I think that's it's part and parcel with the disenfranchisement of black people that has gone on through the entire history of this country. The longer answer is that, and if you talk to the activists here, they'll say that, you know, not enough Americans and not enough lawmakers have ever cared about the plight of DC or even really been aware of the plight of DC and what a lack of statehood means. You know, that there's this perception of Washington, DC, that it's just the swamp, to borrow a phrase from our 45th president, and that it's full of corrupt politicians and nothing else. And it erases the fact that there are 700,000 people who live here, that those people are not all, and not even nearly all, politicians or even working in politics. You know, it's just like any other city or town or state in the rest of the country. But, you know, in the past, there hasn't been the political will to get it across the finish line. The last time they fully voted on statehood in the House before the last 2 years was 1993, and it didn't even pass in the House. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners remember 2009 when there was a fight for congressional vote, just to give DC a congressional vote, not statehood. And it passed in the Senate, but failed in the House because the Republicans attached a amendment that would have basically overridden DC's gun restrictions. And so the thing here is that, again, it's a mix of the same sort of disenfranchisement of black and brown people that this country has that has been a part of this country's history since its founding. And also the fact that, you know, people just, I don't think even realize that DC is a city where real people live, and that statehood causes a whole lot of problems and a whole lot of disenfranchisement and, you know, really a total absence of democracy for the people who live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I mean, on January 6th, you know, you had a local government that had no ability to call out the National Guard because there is no National Guard. They had to go to Maryland.
Right. And, you know, that's well, there is a D.C. National Guard, but D.C. doesn't really control it. You know, a lot of times it has to be mobilized by the federal government.
Right.
And that was the case both, you know, kind of twin cases from opposite sides of during the racial justice protests that took place last summer and then during the insurrection. In one hand, Trump was able to mobilize the National Guard to end the military, you know, to essentially occupy the city. On the other hand, the mayor of Washington had basically no authority to mobilize the National Guard ahead of the Capitol riots when that, you know, it was obvious that there was a threat to the Capitol in that day. And that's just, you know, run down the reasons of, you know, that's a you know, recent symbolic, obvious example of how this messes up DC, but there are so many others. You know, a few years ago, we voted to legalize marijuana here and Congress basically blocked it. And so now we're in this weird gray area where marijuana is legal to possess and use, but not to sell. And all because Congress exerted an authority over the district that they cannot exert over Colorado or California or Washington or anywhere else.
So you can give it away, but you can't sell it.
You can give it away, but you can't sell it. So okay. We have no, it was basically a loophole in the way that the Home Rule Act and everything works, that allowed for a partial implementation of the law, but not full regulatory atmosphere to be, regulatory regime to be set up to allow for legal dispensaries and other methods of selling.
Right. Now, obviously, this is a political issue because if D.C. were to be a state, you'd get two more Democratic senators. I don't see there being any way a Republican wins in D.C. On the short term or even the long term. So, you know, obviously the Republican voters are going to say, no, we can't possibly do this because this is all it's really about. And some of that's true from the outside. You know, as I look into it, I go, look, they should have representation, and two additional senators would not be a bad thing.
Yeah, you know, look, it's a fact of the matter that if Washington, D.C. gets two senators and congressional representation, there are going to be three more Democrats in the Capitol from Washington, D.C. Like, this city voted 95-5 in the last presidential election, and that wasn't because it was Donald Trump. And, like, it was similar numbers when it was Obama versus Romney. It was similar numbers when it was Clinton versus Bush or Clinton versus Dole and Bush versus Gore and so on and so on. But, you know, for one, the Constitution doesn't say you don't get to be a state if you vote for a different party than someone else would prefer. Two, it's just as partisan for Republicans to oppose DC statehood because it would produce two more Democratic senators as it is for Democrats to support it because it would produce two more Democratic senators. And three, and the main reason, is that the residents of Washington, D.C. are not pushing this because they want two Democratic senators. The people behind statehood, the statehood movement in D.C. is based on the fact that they want representation in Congress and they want the right to govern themselves.
So let me ask you this, you know, wouldn't the simple solution be, you know, just add them to Maryland or Virginia or, you know, just add them somewhere. Okay, you're part of this state now. You're just a city. You're Washington, D.C. in the city in the state of Maryland or Virginia. Couldn't you do that?
So retrocession to Maryland is a newly popular idea on the right. You have people like FreedomWorks pushing it, and then Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, a lot of lawmakers in the House are pushing it. But the thing is retrocession doesn't really solve the problem. In fact, it's a perfect example of the problem, which is that DC wants the right to choose its own representation, and retrocession is a solution that would be forced on DC. DC and Maryland touch each other, but they're very distinct, different places. DC hasn't been a part of Maryland for more than 200 years. If you go down the list of states, including Mitt Romney's, including Susan Collins, those weren't states. Those were part of other states the last time DC, or in the case of Utah, didn't even remotely exist. Florida, for instance, as we wrote in the story, was part of Spain the last time DC was a part of Maryland.
Can we give Florida back to Spain?
You know, look, that's a conversation for a different day. But, you know, when it comes down to it, that neither Maryland nor DC supports retrocession of DC to Maryland. It would completely change the politics of Maryland. It would completely, you know, basically fold Washington, DC into a state with which it doesn't identify and isn't a part of and hasn't been a part of at any point anywhere near anyone who's alive's life. And the people of DC have voted, they have spoken, they want statehood, they prefer statehood. And, you know, as far as I can tell, like we put in the headline right there, there's not, when you really go down through it, there's not really a good argument against it. People cite retrocession, they cite various parts of the Constitution, but none of it really addresses the fact or answers the question of why don't the people of Washington, D.C. deserve the sort of representation that they have said they want.
Because that's why. Because I said right. So.
That's essentially what it boils down to.
Yeah, because I said so. So how do you go about doing this? Do we need a constitutional amendment? You said Congress has to vote. How would this work? How would it happen? Because it's not just D.C. There are people talking about statehood for Puerto Rico and other territories. How does this game work?
So with regard to H.R. 51, the law that's in the legislation that passed the House each of the last two sessions, there's a belief among advocates for statehood in DC and in Congress, obviously, that this can be done through simple legislation. That's the way that I believe all 37 new states were added to the Union. There's an argument that DC requires a constitutional amendment because the Constitution requires a federal district, but H.R. 51 specifically carves out I think it's about 2 square miles around the Capitol, the National Mall, and the White House to remain the federal district and just makes the residential areas of D.C. the new state. The Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is the D.C. non-voting delegate to Congress, argues that that's perfectly enough to satisfy the constitutional requirement. It's a little bit different than Puerto Rico and other territories, just because while there are, especially with regards to Puerto Rico statehood movements, there are more complicated questions about colonialism and potential independence there. Whereas with DC, like we've had referendums twice, overwhelmingly have voted for statehood. And so, you know, really there's no question where the District of Columbia stands on statehood. The city council, the mayor, the non-vote, the delegate to Congress, and the population are all united behind the idea that they want statehood.
Yeah, I mean, they are surrounded by states. It would be nice if they were one.
Right, exactly. And you know, it would be nice to have your own representatives in Congress and your own government.
People you can yell at and scream at. I'm right there with them. Sadly, I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, well, so I guess last question I've got, because, you know, if we have to go to if this legislative route is the way to go, is this something that can be done through budget reconciliation? Because it is never getting 60 votes.
I don't think it can be done through reconciliation, but the main group pushing statehood, or one of the main coalitions pushing statehood in DC right now, is called 51 for 51, which, as their name suggests, they want it to be able to be done with 51 votes, a simple majority in the Senate. And what they advocate for is a kind of smaller filibuster reform, not a whole-scale abolition of the filibuster, but a filibuster change or rules change that means that a statehood bill could go through with a simple majority of the Senate.
Yeah.
Again, that seems pretty unlikely.
Here's my problem with that. The second you crack that door open, It's going to give the Republicans the reason to kick it completely off the hinges. So if you're going to crack the door open, just kick it off the hinges.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know that the people behind 51 for 51 are necessarily opposed to a full-scale abolition of the filibuster, but they, with regards to the movement itself, they leave it, you know, just a statehood bill should be able to move through here because other states have been created out of simple majorities. And again, if you go down, other states have been created through legislation. Other states, even if you take the argument that it is only about Democratic senators, many other states were created for purely partisan reasons. And, you know, so there's, as far as I can tell, again, like I'm hardly an unbiased source here. I live in DC. I think statehood is good because I think people deserve representation in democracy. But even setting those aside, if you look at the arguments against it, I just don't think any of them hold water except unless your position is, I don't want statehood.
Or because I said so. If you've got a thought on it, I'd love to hear it. If there's a good reason out there why DC shouldn't be a state, I want to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can also check out Travis's article over at Huffington Post. There's never been a good argument against DC statehood. We'll get links out on social media on how you can take a look at that. Travis, I appreciate your time. Always great talking with you. Keep up the great work, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Anytime, our good friend Travis Waldron. Again, check out that piece. We'll make sure we get links out. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.